W 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CD Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Fox News and Dominion voting systems agreeing to settle a defamation lawsuit over false claims of rigged voting for $787 million. Dominion attorney Justin Nelson says lies have consequences.
For our democracy to endure for another 250 years and hopefully much longer, we must share a commitment to facts.
One worker is dead and five others hurt in a parking garage collapse in New York City. Gabriel Yagadayev works nearby.
We heard a big boom, something out of the ordinary. It just was a really loud noise, something exploded. And I saw people running out quickly from the scene.
Officials call the collapse a pancake. The White House saying the president and first lady made $579,000 last year, paid $137,000 in federal income tax. This is ABC News. A White House intruder. Secret Service quickly captured a visitor who squeezed through the metal fencing, a toddler that was quickly reunited with his parents. The bill says safety Damar Hamlin has been fully cleared to play football again.
This event was life-changing, but it's not the end of my story. So I'm here to announce that I plan on making a comeback to the NFL.
Hamlin collapsed on field, went into cardiac arrest during a Monday night game against the Bengals in early January.
My heart is still in it, my heart is still in the game. I love the game. It's something I want to prove to myself, not nobody else.
Hamlin says all doctors agreed he suffered from commotio cordis. It's a condition that occurs when the heart's rhythm is disrupted due to a blow to the chest that lands at a very specific moment in the heartbeat. An old NASA satellite expected to fall to Earth tomorrow night, but the location hasn't been disclosed. NASA says in a statement the risk of anyone on Earth being harmed by plunging satellite pieces is low. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. A former school board member of the Heartland Lakeside School District who resigned earlier this month is facing three misdemeanor counts of election fraud for allegedly using his father's address on campaign documents during last year's spring election. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporting John Harder facing a fine up to $1,000 or prison time up to 6 months. Harder was elected to a three-year term on the board in 2022, but resigned earlier this month without stating a reason. He's due back in court April 27th. Parts of Wisconsin got hit with more than a foot of snow Sunday night into Monday. The town of Northfield in Jackson County reported 22 inches. Black River Falls with 19.5. The city of Phillips in Price County got 15 inches of new snow, and a foot fell on the Iron County town of Saxon. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and
a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Saturday and Sunday at 1 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
Podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Tax day. Everybody get their taxes in on time. Everybody get the things done. You angry? You mad? You upset? Or do you see it as a patriotic duty? I'm curious where folks' mindset is on a day like tax day. Now, I ran into all the angry people today. and it's one of the, I look at this day as one of those education days. Because, you know, this is the day where we go, this is how we fund stuff. This is how we pay for stuff. This is how we get roads and bridges. And this is how we make lives better and opportunities better. This is how we use resources. And without revenue coming in, we can't do the things that we as citizens want, need, demand, expect. Can't do it. So I find it interesting that, so many angry people. Now, yesterday, as you know, we took the day off. I was in Washington, D.C. for a Patriotic Millionaires event in a room with a bunch of multi-millionaires, a bunch of rich people talking about how they move legislation to tax the people in that room much, much more. And it's one of those things where, when you listen to the stories that they tell and their reasoning for wanting to pay higher taxes, it's because they want to have a civilized society. They want to have opportunities for the next generation that they had. And I say this all the time. I go, I'm not one of those multimillionaires. I brought the collective wealth of the room way down. Now, what's interesting, as someone pointed out to me, I pay a higher percentage of my meager income than anyone in that room does. Because we tax things very differently from people who actually go out and drive trucks and swing hammers and shuffle papers and do whatever it is we do. The secretary pays a higher rate than the owners in a lot of cases. And this is one of those moments where you go, we should be focusing on this. Interesting little story today. And this is kind of, it's right in the tax world. I messed up my knee. So I went and I saw the doctor. And, as we're going out the door, he's like, so, what have you been up to? And I told him the story about, I was in this room full of really rich people that I was the poorest guy in the room. And he's like, oh, yeah, what are you doing? I go, well, they're talking about how to raise taxes. And he's, I pay too many taxes. And I say, this is the problem. You and I are going to stand here and have an argument for the next 3 minutes over should we or should we not raise taxes, thinking that it's about us. It's about our narrow focus, our single-minded narrow focus. And it's not. What they're talking about is something way above our leagues. And here's the thing. I would love to pay taxes in the world that they're talking about. Would love to. I would love it. If you remember Mitt Romney, Remember Mittens when he was running for president, you know, made that famous statement that 47% of the people don't pay any federal taxes, and everyone got outraged and, how dare he? For me, the outrage is 47% of the people don't pay federal taxes, not because they don't want to, but because they don't make enough money to, because they're falling below that minimum poverty line level that we make so that you don't have to pay any taxes. Nobody was upset about that. They were upset at a rich guy who pointed out that, these dregs of society, these lazy, these shiftless. The problem was they don't make enough. And when you look at the fact that the average billionaire in this country pays about an 8% federal tax rate, about 8%, and the average working family pays about 14%, you go, something's off. So as I was talking to my doctor, we were having this conversation, I was going, it's not about you and me. What the wealth class has done masterfully is they've trained us. They've trained you. Now, look, we're even in different tax brackets. You make way more than I do. And good for you. I want you to be happy. I need you to think about your job if you ever have to cut me again. They're not talking about us. They're talking about the kind of wealth that we don't even really understand. And in a way that says, you know what, we do need revenue to come in. And as we were talking, I pointed out the fact that, back in 2020, it was reported by, I think it was Fortune magazine, I think it was everybody at the time, actually, that 55 Fortune 500 companies paid zero income tax. Zero. How is that possible? How is it possible these big multinational corporations have no money? Oh, that's right, because we've allowed them to lobby all of that away in incentives. And the weird thing is we're not getting the return. Because remember, and this is one of those amazing things, and I actually quizzed a couple of people on this. I go, when we give these tax breaks away, when we create these loopholes, why do we do it? And amazingly, everyone got the answer right. So that these companies can take this money, because they're smart and they know what to do with it, and invest it in their business, invest it in new technology, invest it in new job creation, invest it in making better. And I said, what are stock buybacks? Why do we allow those? We've given these companies all this money. They know what to do with it. They're smart. Why do they just take it back? Well, because they can. And it's really not about creating jobs for you and me. It's not about helping us. It's about helping them. And what these patriotic millionaires were talking about is going, look, we need to do some things to our tax code. Our tax code created this massive inequality, the largest inequality in 100 years in this country. We need to do some things to undo what Reagan did in the 80s. And the reality is, and I quizzed my good doctor and said, like I say to everybody, what the top marginal tax rate in 1953 was? Under that great socialist president, Dwight Eisenhower? It was 92%. We're in the mid-30s right now. Our billionaires are not taxed, especially when you throw in the fact that, yes, they've got all kinds of loopholes and all kinds of ways of hiding and sheltering and passing through and passing over and going around. They got all kinds of ways of avoiding paying anything. You, me, people who work for a living, punch a clock. There's no way around that. You're paying it. And that's important because it's about making you angry so that you don't go, hey, maybe we should have a more progressive income tax, which is what the patriotic millionaires are talking about. The idea that money is money is money, that no matter how you get it, it's still money. It's still money coming to you. It's that income word. Whether you worked for it, like you and I do, whether you inherited it because, hey, you won the birth lottery, whether it was through, hey, I invested in a company, hey, I won the lottery, hey, I found it in a paper bag on the street floating down the river, whatever. Income is income, and it should be taxed the same. That was their argument, and I don't think it's a bad argument. Now, how many working people have capital gains that they report? Not a lot. Who has that? The people who are at the very top are 1% of 1%. And they're saying, look, we need to start taxing those people. Or in this case, the people in that room. And their idea is for, people who are have incomes of, again, through however you get it, from $5 to $10 million, that dollar over $5 million, that dollar would be taxed at 50%. From $10 to $25 million, it'd be taxed at 60%. From $25 to $50, it's 70%. $50 to $180, over $100 million. Back to the good old Eisenhower era, 90%. $100 million. Now, let this sink in for a second, because this is the fun part of where we go with this. $100 million would be taxed at 90%. During the good old days of socialist Dwight David Eisenhower, that 92% rate kicked in at about $2 million of today's dollars. So we're talking about in the old days, when the good old days, you know, when we funded education and we built roads and we fought wars and paid for them, they were taxing our gazillionaires at that high rate. Now we've got to go not $2 million, $100 million to get there. And look, this isn't going to pass either, because Republicans will never allow it and Democrats won't allow it. But it's a good start. They also say that we should be raising the standard deduction on your taxes from something that, from where it is now, I think it's like $24,000 for a couple, something like that, to what is a true cost of living. Not a poverty rate cost of living, but a true cost of living. And they put that at about $36,000 for an individual, $56,000 for a married couple. And what does that mean? That means you don't pay any taxes on anything under $36,000 if you're single. You know how many people would then pay no federal taxes? Mitt Romney would dump in his drawers if I had to give you that number. Probably in the 70% range. Probably in the 75% range. So you and me, the working people of this country, would help us. And then they want a wealth tax to try and undo what 40 years of supply-side voodoo Reaganomics has done. Has created massive, enormous generational wealth. And what their idea is if you have 1,000 times the median wealth, if you have 1,000 times the median wealth, they would tax your wealth at 2%. Would you miss that? No. At 10,000 times the median wealth, it'd be at 4%. At 100,000 times the median wealth, it'd be 6%. And if you're Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk with 1,000,000 times the median wealth, you would be taxed at a whopping, an enormous 8%. And the idea here is to try and bring some of that extreme wealth, the 1% of 1% of 1%, back into line with everyone else, and use that revenue in ways that are going to actually help create jobs, make better futures for people, and help alleviate some of the real disaster that's coming. Now you go, but Rick, you know, what do you mean by median wealth? Well, when you do the average wealth in this country, average family household wealth is $746,822. That was a survey done in 2019. It's much higher now. This is the last numbers I could find. Almost $750,000 per family. Let me ask the obvious question to each and every person listening. Do you have an accumulated wealth of $750,000? And if you do, then do you have 1,000 times? Do you have more than that? Now, that's the average. Now, the median household financial wealth is about $121,760, according to the Federal Reserve's 2019 survey. How many families are in at or below that $121,000 in net worth? That means, do you own your house or are you a negative? Do you own your cars or is that a negative? Do you have money in the bank or are you worrying about, you know, overdraft fees? Now imagine that 121,000 number, 1,000 times. Someone has that kind of wealth. Is 2% wealth tax going to crush them? No. Imagine 10,000 times that much. Is it going to crush them? No. But what it will do, it will give us the ability to pay our bills. So no more debt ceiling fights, no more end of looking over into the abyss. We could fund education fully instead of having the hunger games of silver bullet schemes to make profiteers rich and our children get less opportunities. We could have health care. We could have better roads and bridges. We could We could take care of seniors. We could, oh my God, hold on. Whoa, wait a second. We could take care of the veterans that we put up on the pedestal and say how much we love them and how they're heroes, only to when they come home and need help, say, sorry, we're broke. We could do that. Imagine what we could do if we had the kind of wealth that we've given away to the top 1% of 1%. And that's what these folks are talking about. Creating a world that they grew up in. And what was interesting is each one of these guys in their 60s, 70s, I think one of them was even in his 80s, they were saying, I don't see the kind of opportunities that I grew up having in front of me for the next generation. I don't see the kind of environment for people to work hard, play by the rules, and get ahead. The game is rigged. And how do you unrig the game? You start by unrigging the tax code. You start by helping working families to be able to afford to buy a home, to be able to send their kids to college, to have, you know, basic necessity, the basic American dream. And what's interesting is, you know, housing was affordable because of government programs. We built little Levitt towns all over the country in the 50s. When those people were, when the guys were coming back from World War II, we were building tons of housing. We did it with public-private partnerships, gave private corporations money, said, build us affordable housing. And they built hundreds of communities across this country. We can do this stuff again. You just have to have the will, the want, and, well, the political cover. That means you and me. That means working people standing up and saying, we want better. And on tax day, this should be the day where we turn that frothing at the mouth and that anger into action to unrig a system that's been screwing working people over for far too long. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I look at this tax situation. This is something that can be done. We can undo the damage of the Reagan era. And understand, what happened is we created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization by rigging the tax code in their favor. We gave them everything, because we were told the smart people, they're going to know exactly what to do with all the money. And they did. They really did. And to their credit, you know, the rich people knew what to do with all the money that we gave them. They used it to make more. And not for you or for me or for anyone else, but for themselves. They most certainly knew what to do with it. And now they're at the end of this game where the wealth is just generating at such an enormous rate that they're being honest. We don't know what to do with all the money that's flowing in. We've got all these obscene profits from coming out of the pandemic. You know, we can't invest in any more new equipment. We can't buy new facilities. We can't do anything. So we're just going to take it all and put it in our pockets. That's admitting that there's nothing more for them, that we've given them more than they wanted, more than they could deal with. And yet we're still at each other, still foaming. Sad stuff. Let's go to the phones. I've got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you today?
Totally insane as usual.
I'm sorry to hear about your husband. I'm at a loss for words.
Thank you, condolences. Thank you. What I wanted to say was, you know, we're involved with the GOP and with the wealthy and their enablers, and it's like a domestic abuse situation. You know, you have the domestic abuse, he gaslights her, smacks her around, and then says, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry, I won't do it again. And the next day, he smacks her again, rinse and repeat.
Yep.
And that's exactly where we're at with these, you know, the GOP and their enablers and these wealthy people, and they go, oh, you know what, we're so sorry, we won't do it again. And this is after they gaslight us, you know, and tell us, well, we didn't do that, but okay, oh yeah, you found that. Yeah, I guess we did. We're sorry, we won't do it again. So that's where we're at. It's an entire gaslighting situation. It's insane.
It is crazy, and we keep doing it because we ultimately, I think there's part of us that goes, you know, someday I'm going to be Jeff Bezos and I'm not going to want to pay taxes. I'm going to put it out here. You know, the tax ideas that the patriotic millionaires have, I would love to pay 90% tax rate. I would love it. I would be the happiest guy in the world if I had to pay 90%, that 90% tax rate. And you know why that is? Because I would have income. I would have incomes over $100 million.
I'm agreeing with you. It's like, you know, the rest of us, and you're right, because I've actually, upon talking and engaging with some of these enablers of the Republican base, they're like, well, you know, I plan on being wealthy someday, and I don't want to pay that. And I'm like, well, let me think. Right now, what are you getting from that? Because you realize that it comes from the tax dollars, right? So, yeah, you're right, Rick. And you're right. Many of the people, they just, like some abuse victims, they're gullible and they fall for it. But have a good evening, Rick.
Appreciate it, Alice. Thanks so much. No, she's right. I mean, this is an abuse scenario. You know, I remember the Tommy Douglas in Canada. Tommy Douglas is an icon. He's the guy who brought national health care to Canada. But he gave a speech on about what was it, Mouseland? I think they called it Mouseland, where he tells this story about the mice. You know, they go to the polls and they vote for the black cat because the black cat tells them that he's going to give them do all this stuff for them. And the black cats then get into power, and they mandate that the mouse hole has to be bigger so the cat can get his paw in. Well, the mice are upset, and they go to the polls the next time, and they vote for the white mouse, who says, no, it's not going to be a rounded door. It's going to be a square door so the cat can get both hands in. And they go back and forth between the white and the black and then the spotted and the polka-dotted cats, but it's still cats. You know, the mice are still being abused no matter who it is, whether it's the white, the black, the gray, the spotted, the striped. It doesn't matter what cat it is. It's still a cat being in charge of the mouse. And this is the perfect analogy for this. You know, we keep electing rich people to tell us, no, we know what's best for you. We know what's going to help. You know what ends poverty? You know what ends poverty? People having money. That's simple. We figured that out during the pandemic. Making sure that people can pay their bills, making sure that people can put a roof over their heads, keep the lights on, put food on the table. That's how you get people out of poverty, making sure they have the income. I don't hear anybody talking about a national jobs program to help compete with the crummy wage jobs that are out there. Oh, but nobody wants to work. No, nobody wants to work for poverty wages. We're done with that, which is why you're seeing people organizing all over the place. But this is one of those moments where you go, and tax day should be that unifying moment, saying, we should all be in this. Now, what I find interesting is whenever I throw that out, someone says, well, we should have a flat tax. No, a flat tax just makes the rich people happy because the 37% tax rate we have now would go down to 23%. Do you know whose would go up? Ours. So they might pay a little bit more, a touch here or there, but so will you. In fact, the Republican plan that just came out would have gone almost to 30%. But, we're going to do something mean to the people below us. And that's what the wealthy really understand. how to divide, how to conquer, how to tear us apart. And until we stop, and until we demand better, until we stop voting for cats, we're going to keep getting eaten alive. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1908. That was the day the song We Have Fed You All a Thousand Years first appeared. Originally titled The Cry of Toil, it was printed in the Industrial Workers of the World publication, the Industrial Union Bulletin. It was initially attributed to British colonist writer Rudyard Kipling. The song is now understood as an anonymous reworking of Kipling's 1893 poem, The Song of the Dead. The song was wildly popular and reprinted in many union journals. We Have Fed You All was an early example of how the IWW used music and songs in its work. IWW songs projected labor history, struggles, and politics. From union organizing to strike activity to defense cases, Wobblies sought to create a working class culture and community. The IWW is well known for its Little Red Songbook, which contains some of the most popular anthems of the labor movement. The first verse of We Have Fed You All a Thousand Years reads, "We have fed you all for a thousand years, and you hail us still unfed. Though there's never a dollar of all of your wealth, but marks the workers dead. We have yielded our best to give you rest, and you lie in crimson wool. And if blood be the price of all your wealth, good God, we've paid in full." The late Wobbly singer, Utah Phillips, revived the song more recently.
There's never a mind-blown skyward now, but we're buried alive for you. And there's never a wreck drift shoreward now, but we are a ghastly crew. Go and reckon our dead by the forges red and the factory.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Way to go, Wisconsin! In a momentous progressive win, voters there elected County Judge Janet Protasiewicz to their state Supreme Court. She thumped a mega-maga Republican by 11 points in a pivotal race, ending a dark decade of unbridled right-wing partisan extremism by that court's GOP majority. But the vote has profound implications, reaching far beyond the Badger State. Its deeper meaning was brought home to me on Election Eve when the Republican candidate, a Trump-hugging, gerrymandering, anti-choice lawyer, complained that, quote, "doing a statewide campaign is kind of hard." Well, yes, but to paraphrase a song by a band called the Austin Lounge Lizards, campaigning is hard, but it's harder when you're stupid. Not that the lawyer lacked intellect, but smart is as smart does. What the swing state of Wisconsin showed is that this right-wing candidate and other arrogant GOP fanatics are stupid if they think people won't care that, one, Republicans are shutting people out of the voting booth, and two, they're running as ideological autocrats, promising to use state power to outlaw the inherent right of a woman to make her own deeply personal decision about abortion. Moreover, Judge Janet's big win sends a gut-check message to meek Democratic Party officials and donors who continually admonish candidates and local activists to be middle-of-the-roaders, compromising the people's little-d Democratic principles in hopes of winning some Republican votes. Protasiewicz was straight with voters, proudly campaigning to be a pro-choice, pro-worker, pro-democracy justice. This is Jim Hightower saying, because of both the integrity and clarity of her message, she generated a record turnout, greatly increased participation by women and young voters, and, especially noteworthy, made significant inroads in rural and working-class counties that had been considered Trump country. She showed that if Democrats stand up for the people, hello, people will stand up for Democrats.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, we've been talking about here on the program for months now the fact that we're getting screwed over at the cash register all the time. In fact, we talked last week almost every day about Albert Edwards, the economist from this French Bank Societe Generale, saying, look, you know, this is the worst I've ever seen it. Capitalism is broken. Termed the phrase greedflation, although I had used it many times before that. But he's given credit for it. Because corporate America, it's not about supply and demand. It's not about any of those things. It's about opportunity. It's about greed. So are we surprised by it? No. The fact is, it's been going on from the beginning of time. It's only much worse now. But here to share some thoughts on just how bad we are getting screwed over at the cash register, the pumps, everywhere. I've asked our good friend Phil Matera to come talk with us. Phil's a research director over at Good Jobs First. They've got a new report out on how corporations engage in price fixing and, well, some of the stuff that comes out of that. Phil, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here.
So, you know, I've been talking for a while about the fact that, you know, you look at how bad inflation's been. A big part of that, I believe, are, you know, the corporations gouging us to death, fixing prices, doing all of this stuff to benefit themselves and screw us over. How bad is it out there?
Well, it's going on all over the place. And what we look at in this report is a particular way that companies engage in this kind of thing, which is that they conspire with one another. I mean, literally conspire with one another, so that they agree not to undercut each other on prices. You know, because in theory, companies are competing with one another, and, you know, one may want to, you know, lower its prices to, you know, get more of the market. But what, you know, these price fixing cases show is that over and over again, large companies secretly get together and they agree, you know, that the prices are going to be set at a, you know, at least a certain level, and they're not going to try to undercut one another. So that's what's known as price fixing. It's,
right.
It's illegal. It's been illegal since 1890, from, you know, when the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed by Congress, and it just goes on. The cases, you know, we document cases going back to 2000, but actually there were cases before that. And there are cases right up to the present day.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is, you know, we're told that, you know, in the free market, because we're told we are a free market economy. We're told in the free market that the way that you get new customers is by lowering your prices, having better widgets, whatever. But it's that price flexibility that where the competition's supposed to happen. So you're telling me that maybe that competition isn't happening?
No, in many cases it's not. You know. And these are big companies, right? This is not your mom and pop operations. They're not doing this. These are large companies that secretly get together and, you know, in effect, divide up the markets,
yeah,
and decide that prices are not going to go any lower than a certain level.
Well, and, this is the cost of monopoly. I mean, as you have industries, and we found since the pandemic, and I think since the pandemic, a lot of this has been magnified. The fact that, you know, meat producers are like four companies control the vast majority of that. Three companies control the vast majority of cereal production. You know, two or three companies, egg production. Are we surprised that when we consolidate down to those parts that they're doing the kind of behaviors that you're talking about?
Well, we shouldn't be surprised, because this is, you know, this is kind of the underpinning of price fixing. When you have a certain level of concentration, you know, you can have a few big players getting together, carving up the market and setting prices. If you had lots of smaller players, it's a lot likely that that's going to happen.
Now, I always found it interesting. You go buy a car and it's manufactured suggested retail price. That always seemed kind of like price fixing a little bit. This is what we suggest. We somewhat suggest, but it's really, they strongly suggest this is the price. Don't go below this.
Yeah. And what's amazing is that this price fixing stuff goes on in so many different industries. Now, you know, I've been documenting cases in which the companies were caught, right? And even then, there's a wide range of industries. There are likely other instances in which they weren't caught. So the conclusion I reach is basically going on everywhere.
Right. No, you're just getting the tip of the iceberg, because there clearly aren't enough resources out there to have a cop on the beat paying attention to all of this.
Yeah, I mean, the main cops who are supposed to be regulating this are first the Justice Department, the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department. Then the state attorneys general are often doing this. And then usually after a case has been brought by either the feds or the states, then there are private lawsuits that are brought by, you know, groups of plaintiffs to, to get more compensation from the companies.
Right.
And these are, we looked at all three categories of these cases, and we documented over 2,000 of them.
Wow.
They range from, you know, as you mentioned, food products, you know, pork, poultry producers, you know, to, electronics and chemicals and all kinds of things.
What industry is the worst, do you think? I mean, did you do some of the looking at, you know, who the worst offenders were?
Yeah, I mean, if you do it by industry, it turns out that the banks and the financial companies are the worst.
Oh, there's a shock.
And what they do, you know, what they've done is that they've done what's called rigging the interest rate benchmarks. You know, there are these things like, they're known as things like LIBOR, that help to determine what interest rates are internationally. And it turns out that the big banks have kind of gotten together to rig that system many times. They get together and they rig the foreign exchange markets, and they do all kinds of other things. And they've paid the largest amount in penalties. You know, it's about $30 billion out of the 96 come from the financial sector. But then the next biggest are the pharmaceutical companies. And what they do is something that's a little different, but it has the same effect. They do what's called pay for delay. And this is when the brand name, you know, drug companies have a drug that's going off of a patent. And when that happens, they can, in theory, they should no longer be able to charge these exorbitant rates, because generic substitutes can then be brought onto the market. So instead of just accepting that fact, what the drug companies do is that they secretly make deals with the generic companies, basically to pay them off to delay the introduction of their lower cost alternatives. And, you know, they get away with this sometimes, but they also get caught.
Yeah.
And they've been, almost all the big drug companies have been caught doing this. And that industry has paid $11 billion.
So let's focus on them for a second.
Fines and settlements.
Let's focus on them for a second. So the pharmaceutical companies, because this could be life and death stuff here. When they get caught in this, is it just fines, or are we locking people up? Because I'm of the mindset we should be locking these people up.
Well, unfortunately, that doesn't happen as much as it should. I mean, there are some cases, you know, the Justice Department sometimes does bring cases against individual executives, and sometimes they do get locked up, probably in a country club type prison, but occasionally they do get locked up. But most of the time, there are fines and settlements that are paid by the companies.
Yeah, it's slaps on the wrist, and nobody going to jail as they should. Now, you know, we're talking about this price fixing. How is this any different from the kind of greedflation gouging that I think has been happening since the pandemic? The fact that eggs go up from, you know, $1.50 a dozen to, you know, almost $10, that's just outrageous. What's the difference between those?
Well, price fixing and price gouging are related, but they're not exactly the same thing. Price gouging is basically when a company by itself decides to hike up its prices. And strangely enough, that's often not illegal. but price fixing is when two or more companies get together and secretly decide not to compete with one another, that they're going to set a minimum price and not go below that. Federal antitrust law prohibits that kind of behavior. And that's why you see all of these cases for price fixing. You don't see as many cases for price gouging, because often they can just get away with it. They're not breaking any law, believe it or not.
They just get away with it. But again, we go back to what you said a moment ago. What would you say? How many cases since 2000?
Over 2,000 cases, about 600 by federal and state prosecutors, and about 1,400 class action lawsuits.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that's a drop in the bucket, I think, in our economy. I got to imagine this stuff is going on. Because what's interesting is you go, no matter where you go, no matter what product it is, they always seem to be within a penny or two of each other. There doesn't seem to be, the wide, price variances that you would expect if you were in a true competitive market where people are fighting for market share. It seems like everything's kind of on this kind of price fixing panel.
Yeah, but the only time they can be prosecuted is when you can prove that the executives literally conspired, that they got together secretly and made a covert deal. That's what is the violation of the federal antitrust law. And you can't always prove that. And I mean, it probably goes on all the time, but the cases, the successful prosecutions are only ones in which there's evidence of that deliberate collusion.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Phil Matera. He's a research director over at Good Jobs First. GoodJobsFirst.org is their website. They got this new report out, Conspiring Against Competition, Illegal Corporate Price Fixing in the U.S. Economy. That is the report's name. You can find that. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. So in looking and doing this work, what are you hoping comes out of this? I mean, is it just raising awareness for consumers, maybe calling their legislators, maybe demanding more enforcement? What's the hope out of this?
Well, all of that, actually. We're hoping that people are more aware of this and that they put more pressure on federal and state officials, to crack down even more and try to, limit these illegal practices and hopefully bring down prices a little bit, because this is, although price fixing was happening before the current crisis and the current inflation, certainly makes it worse.
Right. Any idea how much this has to do with the inflation that we've been suffering under? I know that the kind of, not price fixing, but the kind of gouging, there have been some people, some economists saying, anywhere between 50 and 55% of the inflation that we're dealing with is because of this kind of gouging. How big of a deal is this in that world, do you think?
Yeah, we weren't able to make an estimate like that, but clearly I think because there's so much overlap, I would say that a lot of the estimates of price gouging in effect are incorporating price fixing, because really companies can only get away, in many cases they can get away with the price gouging because they've engaged in these secret deals with their supposed competitors. So the two really work hand in hand.
No, I got to tell you, I find it, the fact that you pointed out that there are all of these since 2000, that, $96 billion in fine, and just thinking about how hard it must be to prove this kind of collusion, given the fact that, you can have, conferences of these people coming together in back rooms. I find it incredible that many have been found.
Yeah, I think it's all often happens because of whistleblowers, or people who, maybe are just turned off by the whole thing and decide to, come clean.
Yeah.
But clearly, there's a lot more going on than the prosecutors are able to document.
So, last question I've got for you: How do we get our legislators? How do we get the senators? Because I've been calling for a Truman-like commission to go after war profiteers since the pandemic. Start calling in some of these price gougers. How do legislators? How do we stop this kind of stuff? How do we get better enforcement? Is there a policy prescription? What are you thinking?
Well, I think the first thing would be to to have some high-profile hearings to document and document the problem, both the price fixing and price gouging, to draw even more public attention to the problem and make people realize, you know, what's causing it. And then out of that, you know, there need to be stricter penalties, and stricter penalties both against the outright collusion and just the price gouging. Even if you can't prove the conspiracy, the government should still be doing something, you know, to deal with these practices.
Yeah. This is one of those areas that I'm in favor of capital punishment. I think we kill off a couple of corporations, I think people get right in the line. At least that's what I'm told. You know, people tell me with the death penalty why they're in favor of it. Let's try it on corporations first.
Okay, yeah. They don't like to do that in this country, but that may be what it takes.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. I hope folks will take a look at the report. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at conspiring against competition, illegal corporate price fixing in the U.S. economy. Phil Matera, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Thanks so much.
Good to do so. Take care.
Remember, check out their website, goodjobsfirst.com. They do incredible work over there. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1857. That was the day that Clarence Darrow was born in Kinsman, Ohio. Darrow was perhaps the original U.S. labor lawyer. Known to be a friend to underdogs, Darrow once supposedly said, quote, "Lost causes are the only ones worth fighting for." Clarence learned his concern for his fellow man from his family. His childhood home was a stop on the Underground Railroad. In 1887, Clarence moved to Chicago to pursue his law career. But his first big client was not an underdog. In fact, he ended up working as the general counsel for the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. But then the 1894 strike by Pullman workers led him to quit his job. And instead, he defended Eugene V. Debs, the president of the American Railway Union. Debs had been imprisoned for his support of the striking Pullman workers. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Although Darrow lost, his reputation as a lawyer for labor was sealed. Over the years, he would go on to successfully defend Big Bill Haywood, leader of the Industrial Workers of the World, when he was accused of murder. Darrow's most well-known case, however, was the Scopes trial. Darrow defended a high school teacher, John Scopes, who had the audacity to teach evolution to high school students in Tennessee, something that was quite controversial at the time. The trial became a major news event. 200 reporters from across the nation covered the case. Darrow won, which was seen as a major shift towards the teaching of science in the classroom. Clarence Darrow is still beloved in Chicago, which holds a ceremony each year remembering his work as a champion of the people. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I got an email. This is one of those good email. But you know, maybe not, you know. I love when people send me emails and tell me what they're thinking. I got an email from Randy. Randy listening on KTRC in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He said, "Rick, let me start off by saying I'm 100% with you on your economic message. We need an economy that works for us. But," here comes the but, "I listened to your argument about having
to preemptively shoot someone who raises their voice to you, and I think that is stupid. Gun owners are law-abiding citizens who have an absolute right to defend themselves, their families, and their property. We gun owners don't want the country to become the Wild West, but we are prepared when it does. When it does. Stop bad-mouthing gun owners, Randy, here in Santa Fe. Look, I'm a gun owner. I got one, you know, within arm's reach. You know, I don't think all gun owners are bad. The reality is we got too many gun stuff going on because we've got people who, I don't know that we should be. I point to this story in New York. A car pulls into a driveway. 65-year-old guy decides that he doesn't like a car in his driveway. Shoots and kills this 20-year-old girl for pulling into the driveway for the egregious crime of being at the wrong house. Oh, and you think that, oh, that's rare. It happened the day before. Teenager goes and knocks on a door. 80-year-old guy blows him away. Oops. And this is one of those things where you keep coming back to this moment where we have all these shootings. I mean, another one up in Maine. Guy goes and shoots a bunch of people in the house, then driving down the road, just shooting people at random. No, not all gun owners are bad, but some are. And maybe we do need to have some rational laws. And my argument is with these stand your ground laws, with these castle doctrine laws that have given people this idea that if someone pulls into my driveway, I can shoot them. If someone knocks on my door, I can shoot them because all I have to do is somehow say, you know, I was in fear. Instead of having laws that say, you know what, we're going to look at each individual case on its merits. The weird thing is I've known people over the years who, you know, I remember the first, when I moved to Pennsylvania, the first guy I met in the lunchroom was talking about, in the most pornographic of terms, how he wanted to pull out his new big whatever the heck it was and wanted to stick it to somebody. And, you know, this just this fantasy of, you know, being the hero and this. And it was like 20 minutes of pornographic description of shooting and killing someone. And I remember when he was done, I said, you know, the reality is you should have no guns. You should be the one person who's never allowed to have a gun. Because of that kind of fantasy thinking. And look, we've got more guns than people. And I'm still waiting for, as you know, John Stewart said, you know, when do we get to that safety point? I'm not anti-gun, but you know, the reality is, you know, we have a society that's broken. I've been watching these TikTok videos and they're all the same. I know there's a pot of rich people money out there pushing this message of people saying it's not the guns. It's the fact that we don't have enough God. And I'm going, what? And I would say, you know, the reality is, you know, and they go, it goes along this way. You know, when I was a kid, everyone had a shotgun rack and they went hunting after school and they did all these things. Everyone had guns. You know what everyone didn't have back then? They didn't have 100-clip magazines. They didn't have guns that could, take out an entire room or an entire shopping mall. They didn't have the kind of firepower that we have today. But they also had hope. And this is where I come back to. I'm glad to hear that you're 100% in line with my economic views and how we make this economy better and how we give people hope. The one thing that all of these shooters seem to have in common is they saw no path forward for them. There was no future for them. There was no opportunity for them. They were, you know, bullied in one way. They were, fired out of jobs. There was no belief that there's a future. And I think a lot of that comes back down to our media culture, the fact that, you know, things are getting worse and we only focus on the negative. But also the fact that we have such a rigged economy and such a just such a screwed up system for some. Where I think if you had the hope of a future, the want of a future, I don't know, maybe you would do things differently. But again, as someone who has been shot at and has seen people being shot at back in the old days when it was just a six shooter.
You know, you had the old 38 special. You could count to six pretty simply. Now with the kind of magazines and the quick change clips and all this stuff, if you're being shot at, you don't have a chance. That's my problem, Randy. But I do appreciate the thoughts. I always appreciate someone weighing in and sharing some. I would love to hear your ideas on how we stop these mass shootings and how we stop people driving down the road, you know, playing duel on the highway. And then both their kids get shot.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News.